Predictive Modeling, Pitfalls, and Potentials. For those of you who may not know me, I'm Jeff Kuchera. I'm a senior consultant with EMB America. There are a couple seats still in front if you want to come up. Today we're going to be talking about predictive modeling. We're going to give you some of the what I'm going to call the practical aspects of it. We've got three different viewpoints. We're going to present it from a consultant's viewpoint, a company actuary, and then probably most interesting, how the regulator views a lot of this. For those of you who may not know me, I've been in consulting for about 5 years. Before that, I was a company actuary for about 25 years at Allstate. So I've seen both aspects of it. Predictive modeling, as you know, is kind of the new thing for actuaries, and particularly in the U.S. Also serving on today's panel is Mike Larson. Mike works in the personal lines actuarial department at The Hartford, where he functions as an internal consultant. Mike is a member of the American Academy of Actuaries and became a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society in 1982. He has served on the examination committees, the Dynamic Risk Modeling Committee, and has spoken at loss reserve seminars. Mike has a master's in actuarial science from the Graduate School of Business at the University of Michigan. On the far right is John Pedrick. John is the Assistant Director for Property and Casualty Services at the Ohio Department of Insurance, where he manages the regulatory process for P&C contracts, rates, statistical reporting, and market research. He has worked for the department since 1995. John was part of the department's support staff to the Ohio Medical Malpractice Commission and testified as an expert witness on P&C rates. He helps to produce many of the department's reports on P&C markets and advises on various legislative matters. He represents the department on several committees of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, including the P&C C Committee, the Casualty Actuarial Task Force, the Statistical Information Task Force, the Profitability Working Group, which he chairs, and the Catastrophe Insurance Working Group. He is also one of five experts on the NAIC advisory panel to the Federal Trade Commission's credit scoring study. He is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society, where he chairs the Committee on Rate Making, and is a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. As I mentioned previously, we'll be trying to give you three different viewpoints. I'm going to ask that we hold off all questions to the end, just so that we can make sure we get through the presentations, at which point in time we will open it up. So with that, let me begin. What I'm going to be talking about are three things. Kind of the purpose of predictive modeling, what I view as some of the benefits, and then some of the pitfalls that we see quite frequently. The purpose is actually relatively simple. It's to predict a response variable using a series of explanatory variables, or particularly what we usually think about it, rating factors. It's not a whole lot different than a lot of things we've done, but it takes the statistical model and it helps get those results. What are the benefits? Well, quite simply speaking, one is it corrects a lot of the method, I won't get that word out. Yes, thank you. Systematic flaw. mouth don't fail me now. And what do we mean by that? It corrects for a lot of things like the distribution biases that we have in almost all of our data, the fact that a lot of the variables that we use and the things we look at are correlated to some degree. So it does that a lot better. Another thing that's very unique about it, or very beneficial and very powerful, is it can do more with less data, if you will. The way multivariate analysis and a lot of softwares work, you don't need the same amount of data that you may have in the past. So it actually allows companies that are smaller than, say, you know, one of the top five writers to be able to do a lot more predictive type modeling with their own data. It provides some very good diagnostics to support decision making. There's a lot of good statistical tests that can be run so that you can tell for sure much better than, gee, I think this looks good, that we've traditionally used or we think it's right. You can actually do a lot of statistical models or statistical tests, compare models. You can see the benefits that's added by adding new variables or subtracting new variables. So it does that. And it eliminates time-consuming adjustments. Once actually you get set up typically using a software package or any other method of GLM, it's actually quicker and easier a lot of times than some of the old traditional methods. And that's the, you know, the hardest part, though, is that first time through getting organized and getting your data and getting everything ready. Predictive modeling is being successfully applied within the insurance industry. It continues to be used more and more. We're starting to see it, obviously, a lot in the pricing area, but you also will see it more and more in the underwriting, marketing, and claims. And what are some of the actual applications that we've seen and that we talk about? Go through them a little bit. From a pricing standpoint, obviously, it can help set base rates. It identifies the predictors, those variables that do add value in predicting losses. It quantifies the relationships between variables. What we're also looking into, though, now is going kind of that next step beyond what might have been the obvious. And what I mean by that are things like it can enhance current programs. You can take make and model as an example, and you can start adding additional variables to enhance that. You can do special scores. I do a lot of work in the homeowner's end as an example. And the question is, you know, how good or how valuable are fire protection classes? How can those be improved upon? And you can actually build individual scores that would take into consideration things like distance to the fire department, type of fire department, water availability. You can then tie in some of the individual home characteristics, such as the construction, number of residents in the home, age of the electrical system, to develop, if you will, an individual home fire protection score. So there's all kinds of possibilities of use for predictive modeling. It's a question really of where do we want to let our imagination go, if you will, and what do we want to think about, and how do we want to apply it. From an underwriting standpoint, it's been used already to determine a lot of underwriting rules, which risk do I want to accept, which don't. Tied into that is obviously the tiering programs. It can be used to perform credit analysis. You can do individual or proprietary credit algorithms and studies. You can create profitability curves so that you know where your real true profitability is, where it, you know, it kind of falls off. You can evaluate agents and regions. A much better way of actually tying in and saying, do we seem to have a discrepancy with certain types of agents, regions? Is there something in the way that they're doing by adding them as a variable? From a homeowner standpoint, a lot of companies like to do inspections of homeowners. You can actually build algorithms so that you can target your inspections so that you can, if you will, get a lot more bang for your buck by saying which inspections are we really going to end up taking action on, or what is, you know, how do we increase that probability of taking action on versus just saying we're going to randomly inspect all of these homes or every home. So there's a lot of application there. Marketing, it's starting to be used to predict response rates. If I'm in particular a direct writer, what are certain variables so that I know and how can I tie that in? You can perform conversion analysis, which I think is probably one of the next steps that a lot of companies will be taking, is tying in conversion analysis to rate changes so they can get a much truer feel for what the real effect of a rate change is. You know, traditionally we've said, if our book doesn't change, we're going to get 7% from this rate change. Well, the fact of the matter is every time a rate change is implemented, the book usually does change. You have certain, you know, people that are less likely to renew, others that may be more likely. How does that change, not only from, you know, from a premium generated, but from the losses expected then? And how does it change my overall true rate change? Instead of a 7% change, it might be anywhere from 3% to 12%, depending on how the marketplace in my current book may react. And that, once again, is also tied in to retention. From a claim standpoint, it can be used to help set reserves. It can be used to predict fraud. It can be used to predict lawsuits. So once again, what we're seeing is predictive modeling is greatly enhancing our ability to look at things, to get a better understanding and feel for it. It really is a question of having the proper data and being able to look at it and understanding that the tool is there for us to use. Is it effective? Well, we have shown this slide to a lot of our clients. And this basically takes the companies that we believe are using predictive modeling and have been using it for some time on a real regular basis. And we looked at the private passenger auto combined ratio. And what's very amazing is the gap that has been created and the difference by those companies who appear to be using predictive modeling on a regular basis. What I think for me adds a lot of credibility to this slide is that generally the two lines seem to follow each other pretty closely. So the overall industry trends seem to be the same, but the fact is those companies using predictive modeling and that are committed to it over the last 7 or 8 years have built quite a competitive advantage for themselves. And that, more than anything, I think is the proof of the pudding, if you will, just how valuable and how powerful predictive modeling is. What are some of the pitfalls? Well, we're going to talk about five areas, and these are what I'll call my perspective as a consultant that we see, and we're talking about data, IT availability, shortcutting the process, treating predictive modeling as a black box, and senior management understanding and buy-in. Data, I've called it a pitfall, and it really, I guess, probably deserves to be more classified as one of those questionable areas. The reason I say it's a pitfall frequently for companies is because it becomes their excuse. The data isn't perfect. I don't have everything I want, so, gee, I guess I won't do anything. That seems to be kind of a common predicament with a lot of companies. The questions that have to be asked is, what data is available? How good or how clean is it? A lot of times we find companies that, yeah, we have data, and when you start looking at it and you find out that because they haven't been using it for several years for anything, it's garbage. There's a lot of miscodes and stuff. There's also, where do I go for additional items? There's a lot of companies throw their hands up in the air and say, I don't have these items. Where do I go? Well, there are a lot of vendors, and the vendors are becoming more and more creative, and their ability to produce additional data that can be appended to the records has grown exponentially over the last few years. How soon can I have data ready for analysis? That varies a lot by companies, and it seems to be a real pitfall for a lot of companies, particularly once you get by what I'll call their major line, which is usually private passenger auto. It's usually, I can get that, but if I want to look at homeowners, if I want to look at one of my commercial lines, if I want to look at something else, that seems to take a lot of additional time. And really tied into this and to the next point is what I call the biggest pitfall, one of the biggest failures of companies, is to recognize and realize they can make incremental improvements. Yeah, the bottom line is you don't have to score a touchdown, if you will. You have to make progress. And a lot of companies are looking for this perfect rating plan. They want to go all the way and have it absolutely right the first time through. And because of that, they end up doing nothing or very little. So I think with respect to data, the question really has to be is, what do I have currently available? What can I use? And what type of incremental improvement can I expect or should I be looking forward to? Tied into that, obviously, is IT, and a lot of the same comments would apply. True pitfalls. Changes will occur. That is true. Eventually, for most, you know, it's going to be significant changes to the way we rate, either because of the number of variables, the way we may correlate or combine certain variables, brand new variables we want to look at. Changes eventually will be significant. IT must be part of the process, and the earlier, the better. I think a mistake that a lot of companies make is, let's go out, design our plan, when we're all done and we really like it, let's bring in IT. And what happens, my experience has been, is whenever that occurs, whether they can do it or not, their first reaction of IT is, we can't do that, not within 400 years. They have to be part of the pitfall, or part of the process. You know, some days are just better than others. What are what I refer to as false pitfalls, things that a lot of companies say, oh man, this is a problem, is that all changes must be a monumental task. I think a lot of companies walk into that feeling that, and the fact of the matter is that's not true. There's a lot of what I'll refer to as low-hanging fruit that can be done. A lot of times it's sitting down and saying, okay, what do we have available that we could use? A good example is, and I'm going to use homeowners since I'm very comfortable and familiar with it. I've been a proponent for rating homeowners by peril for several years now. And invariably we hear, gee, you can't do that from a system standpoint. Well, I've had a couple of companies when the simple suggestion was made is, what if you took your auto rating system and used it for homeowners? What if you called fire BI and you called water PD and you just said, we'll make a rule that says you have to buy all the coverages, and you took your auto rating algorithm, if you will, to use for homeowners. Could you do it then? A couple of them come back and say, you know what, we can, and it's not all that difficult. Those are the types of things we talk about, false pitfalls that you don't have to have. The other one is, you hear frequently, is nothing can be accomplished in the current framework. Well, frequently, that's not true. I mean, the bottom line is, if you took your current rate plan and did nothing but say, I'm just going to recalculate my factors using GLM without changing a single rating variable, you're going to have improvements. You're going to be better off. Is it where you ultimately want to be? Probably not. But the bottom line is, it's a step forward. And that's what you need to work, and that's what you need to get IT and data system, you know, the areas. You have to get over the hurdle that, wow, we can't do it because we don't have as good a data as XYZ company or as much data. Doesn't matter. You can still move forward. Shortcutting the process. One is, if you're going to use GLM, whether you're using, you know, something on your own or whether you're using a company software, you need to make sure you get the proper training and the proper understanding. It's like anything else, a little knowledge can be dangerous. Practitioners, a lot of them want us to continue to perform loss ratio modeling using GLM. And while it certainly is a possibility, it's not near as effective and it's not near as good as using frequency and severity. We have historically used loss ratio as kind of trying, as a way to try and understand some of the distribution biases. But when you get to GLM, you don't need to do that. And it becomes very, very difficult, actually, if you do want to use loss ratio modeling. Now, I will tell you that a lot of companies, though, are so used to, I want to see the loss ratios, you're going to be asked for it. And you have to kind of explain that that's not the best way to do it. Predictive modeling, it shouldn't be considered an automated process. You have to still stop and think about what you're doing, make sure you take the right steps, and make sure that you're paying attention and getting the right data into the system. Treating predictive modeling as a black box. You have to understand, you get a lot of very good answers from predictive modeling. Don't just take the answers and run. You know, apply the practicality test. Does it make sense? Does it work? A lot of modelers want to build models that are just far more complex than they need to be. It's kind of, and actuaries, I think, are guilty of this sometimes. It's, you know, why draw a straight line if you can draw 14 curves? there's a time and a place where the curves are valuable and it's helpful, but models do not necessarily have to be near as complex as a lot of companies are making them. Surprisingly enough, the UK, which has been using GLM much longer than we have, their models usually are a lot, you know, for those companies that are more advanced in this, are typically a lot simpler than a lot of the U.S. models. Appropriate diagnostics can ensure model is not just explaining the past. That's the other advantage we have with GLM, is there is a lot of diagnostic tools available. You have to make sure you're looking at them and checking them and not just taking the answers and finding out, wow, you know what, when I check my statistical test after the fact, that last one didn't really add all that much value or didn't add any value. Some companies will implement results blindly. This is an actual true example from some work that one of my peers was involved with. And, you know, it asked the question, do the indications make sense? This was something by vehicle age that showed that as the vehicle aged, it should actually increase in rates and then go back down. Now, that intuitively, that doesn't make a lot of sense. When they actually took time to meet with people, in this case in particular, the claims people, and look and ask some, you know, questions about some of this, what they found was is that in reality they had a problem in the claims department. The claims department very knowingly was, they had claim leakage in the older model years. Whatever the reason being is they knew that for years 3 through 5 or 3 through 6, they were overpaying their claims. It was a conscientious decision up to that point in time. No one had ever understood the ramifications of the results till they looked at this. But the bottom line was, is they didn't need to adjust these relativities. They needed to meet with claims and adjust claims and fix claims. And it's a great example of, take a look at your results, Do they make sense? Are you talking to other people to find out, are there other things affecting this? The biggest mistake, and maybe the real true pitfall that we can pull out of this, is you don't communicate with other departments. As actuaries, we go off, we do our work, we let the numbers tell us the answers, we're not communicating, and yeah, they give us the indication, but do we really want to continue to do business that way? And is that really what we should be about? The communications with other departments is absolutely critical. Related to that is you also have to ask the question, what are the impacts on the policyholder? Do I want to do this all at once? What's my own personal company philosophies on policyholder impact? What will they do to competitiveness? Profit level, how will that be affected? And then the real question is always, and should always be part of the discussion, will the problem be better addressed by another action? So it's not just rates. Last, and certainly not least, is what I call senior management understanding and buy-in. And I will tell you that this probably has been one of the most difficult things and one of the biggest pitfalls and roadblocks into effectively introducing GLM. As you get into GLM, a lot of the ways we have done business traditionally in the past change. We get into underwriting a lot more by profitability versus frequency. And for senior management, people like myself who've been around for 30 years and have been taught one way to do stuff, to all of a sudden have someone come in and say, throw that away, we're going to do things differently. It's okay to write drivers with violations because we've got a nice rate now for them. We're very comfortable with the rate that's being charged. Senior management doesn't always buy into that real quick. And if they're not constantly told about what's going on, what to expect, I guarantee that as the actuaries get this nice GLM rating package and program to roll out, it's going to get nitpicked to death. I've seen it over and over again because senior management has not been part of the process, has not been educated what to expect and how it's going to do. The other thing you'll find, very common, is that senior management will have favorite risk. I always refer to it as the person they see in the mirror every day. But if you look at, and as you get into GLM, one of the things you're going to find is that this, quote, best risk that we've been all talking about from a profitability standpoint isn't all that good because we've discounted it to know, you know, every way we possibly could because it looks exactly like me, and so I should get a very low rate. I know the three accidents were truly, in my case, accidents. I should get a great rate. And I mean, people have that tendency. And all of a sudden you're saying, you know what, from a profitability standpoint, that risk probably should be, one, getting a higher premium, or we shouldn't be near as anxious about it. I mean, the company, if you want to think about one company who's understood that better over the years, it's probably Progressive. Progressive has always understood that it's not necessarily the best driver who's the best insurance risk. It's the one that I have the most adequate premium for. Those aren't always the same people. The other thing is as we're doing more and more of this work, it's going to probably be a lot more dynamic than it has been in the past. I mean, our best risk today from a profitability standpoint may not always be true, 6 months or a year down the road. So how does underwriting keep up with that? This one, as I said, it sounds simple. It sounds real easy, getting senior management buy-in. But I will tell you, my experience has been it may be the most difficult from start to finish, unless senior management can be talked to. It's kind of, if you want to think about it like advertising, you have to get the message across 17 times before it's heard. It's similar with senior management. So with that, I will now turn it over to Mike.
The microphone a little bit. So carrying on the theme, we're going to talk about some of the practical aspects of introducing predictive modeling to a group of people that are outside the research area. And I'm going to talk about how do you go from the idea that this is a good idea, I'd like to do it, to know we're really going to start to do it in our department. One of the first things you have to do is to explain to them, why do we need to change? You need to give them some examples about what do you mean we can do better than we were doing before. The one-way loss ratios have been very effective for a while. Why should I change what I'm doing? Some of the pitfalls along the way to implementing these changes can be caused by not thinking about, well, what do we have to do to implement the change? What type of new tools do we need? How will those new tools fit in with prior tools we have today? How are we going to train the people to use this new technology? It's not obvious the first time you open up the screen, even as nice as the software is today, how to make things work. You have to be prepared to think of how to introduce that new technology to these people. And finally, you have to think a little bit about the peer review process. Because if you're introducing something that's new, it's even more critical that somebody else looks at what you're doing. Yet, if you don't have a number of trained people on staff to look at your work, you're in kind of a bind at that point. So we're going to talk a little bit about these practical concerns about changing to the better world of predictive modeling. First thing, the thing we'll probably spend the most time on will be some of the examples that you could use to explain to a group why do we need to go beyond looking at the one-way loss ratios. And we'll spend some time on that and briefly talk about some of the considerations in looking at the analytical tools that you need to make predictive modeling work in your shop, and think about the training and personnel issues involved. And finally, a few questions about the peer review process. So the examples that I have are homeowner examples, and Jeff would like those. Specifically, we're going to look at cap loss ratios. In this particular case, I'm looking at loss ratios because I'm trying to reach out and talk to the people who are used to looking at one-way loss ratio tables to look at how their rating factors should change. So we'll start out with those one-way loss ratios and work through using some predictive modeling to see what type of answer you would get. In this particular case, the variables we'd include would be the amount of insurance group, deductible size group, territory, construction, and experience year. Should mention the loss ratios were brought to premium at current rate level through extension of exposures, which is one of the things you would need to do to successfully model loss ratios in a predictive modeling environment. Okay, so this is the first one-way table. You start to look at it and say, well, it looks like there are some indications, and this dimension, the rows are the amount of insurance figures, and I grouped them because we have fairly sparse data by amount of insurance, unless you start to group it. And then we also had deductibles across the columns. And indications are there's some change, some indicated change by both the deductible amount and by amount of insurance. Okay, so the people we've been working with are probably used to seeing those type of loss ratio indications by their different rating groups. Look at construction type 2 for frame and masonry, as well as looking at the interconnection between the amount of insurance. Doesn't look like there's much there in terms of indicated change for this by masonry or by construction type group. The next graph is where we start to make the case, why should you go into the predictive modeling category? And what it's showing is that if you look at how you write the business, the amount of insurance is highly correlated with the territory you're in. It's not a random effect. So if you're looking at amount of insurance loss ratio relativities, that could be influenced strongly just by the territory base rates in which you're looking at that experience. The way the graph works is going from left to right to show the territories, and the bars by color code show the distribution or the percentage of business in that territory for that given amount of insurance group. So you can see, looking at the varying height of the bars, that there's a lot of correlation between amount of insurance and the territory group. Next slide, if you look at the loss ratios by territory, you can see too that the loss ratios by territory vary a lot too. So you've got these two things going on. The distribution of where you're writing is correlated with territory, and your territorial loss ratios are not all the same. So it becomes a more complicated issue, and that's where predictive modeling comes to the rescue. To make a few comments about what to look at next, it doesn't look like we need to spend a lot of time on construction type. We'll focus on amount of insurance and deductible size. Okay. So to lead up to this type of slide, you probably want to spend some more time, but this summarizes the work that was done. I took the natural logarithm of the loss ratios and modeled it. And this is an ANOVA table. I'm looking at the type 3 type of ANOVA results. And the comments show that if we look at the combination of amount of insurance, deductible, and the territory, well, it looks like the amount of insurance loss ratios don't vary systematically, which is not the same as you picture as you get just from looking at the one-way loss ratio table. So you can start to make the case that the one-way tables, looking at your own experience, can give you misleading results. And do a little bit of work looking at, well, maybe there's some interaction. Interaction is a term where it means that the rate of change for amount of insurance is somehow connected with the deductible attached to that home. It turns out that to be significant. But this points out that you, and you can point out to the group you're working with, you can start to systematically test which items in your rating plan should be changed, not because I just look at the picture and that's what it seems like to me today. I have some tests that I can refer to make a systematic choice. And this is the final model that comes out. Don't show the parameters, I'm just showing the ANOVA table to show that in the end, the amount of insurance table indicated changes dropped out of the picture when you start to account for the fact that you've got territory changes going on as well. So this is a practical example that I could use to help motivate people. Why should I learn? Why do I need to pick up this new skill? So that's the conclusion. I stated the conclusion. We had to adjust the deductible factors, but not the amount of insurance factors. It's not the same result that you would get just by looking at the one-way tables. Okay. The second example follows a similar theme, where we start to look at one-way loss ratio tables, looking at the bottom row for the loss ratios by deductible type and the amount of insurance on the far right-hand column. There are some indications that maybe the amount of insurance factors should change. Deductible factors should change, too. That's a one-way view of the world, though. But it's a view of the world that they probably be comfortable with seeing. You start to look at this for the construction type, and once again, construction type's not too interesting, so we won't have to look at that more. I should mention that even though I kind of belittle looking at the one-way tables, it's a good way to start the analysis. What do you want to look at? My territory numbers all ran together on the bottom of the graph while I was sanitizing this so I could show this. But it, again, the same picture that as the last time, that territory is highly correlated with the amount of insurance. So if I have variation in my base rate adequacy by territory, that kind of carries over into any measurement I would have for the amount of insurance group relativities. So you need some tool that's going to untangle this relationship for you. You can see the loss ratios vary by territory. So I'm not going to spend time looking at the construction type. Again, you get to the analysis table and say, well, what if I run, after I run this through the predictive modeling software I have, what actually seems to be a valid way or a valid set of factors to start to change? And I have the ANOVA table, the type 3 ANOVA table, that gives me a systematic input into which factors, if I look at the loss ratio relativities, are significantly different from zero, or that there is a consistent need to change these things. And in this particular case, it looks like deductible groups fall out. That's what we end up with. So it's a way, this is one way of presenting the fact that we need to change. And you want to give them a concrete example that if you just use what you're used to using, the one-way loss ratio tables, you wouldn't be happy with the results once the rate change went through because you wouldn't have correctly estimated which set of factors need to be adjusted. Okay, got to give people a reason to change because for many individuals, I'll just say this slide, for many individuals, they've grown very comfortable in using the tools that they've used for years. Now you're going to ask them to pick up a new vocabulary, relearn concepts they may not have seen since college, if then, to be able to successfully apply this. So you have to provide some motivation. Okay, so the potential pitfalls are, so that's the benefit, that you can really do better in your analysis using the predictive modeling. The pitfalls come in the implementation, where you may not stop and think through what things do I need to do to allow the people in my area to do better. One of the first things to think about would be the new tools. I'm not going to talk about any specific software packages other than to say that there are a lot of good packages out today. You have to try them out for yourself. And I'd say, too, that some of us have this image that we can do our own programming and construct our own tools. Well, at this point, I think you're much better off to look to outside vendors because they've tested this stuff for you. And it's pretty time consuming to build and integrate all these things. And you have to go, so at this point, you have to go beyond Excel and think about what type of tool you want. Some of the considerations involved in looking at the different staff packages that are available. First, what type of connection exists between that package and your data set? It's a big concern. If you're used to using a set of relational databases and that particular staff package doesn't have an easy bridge to your particular set of relational databases, that's a real problem. You have to think, too, about the data manipulation capabilities that the staff package has versus what you need. In doing the work, I found that I end up spending more time doing the data work to get it into the right form, often, than doing the analysis. The analysis is often very fast, given the nice tools that are available today. The data work, though, is problematic. Another consideration is ease of use. You know, is it obvious what to do when you open up the package? Where would you start? And the type of training support that's available and the help screens that are available. Now, even though the packages lower the barrier from what it was before, where you had to be a programmer in a sense to get very far in the statistical analysis, it still requires some training. You still have to stop and understand what's going on behind the scenes when you review the results. If you don't do that, it's just a faster way to make errors. And just look at the diagnostics and documentation. And it's a very important thing for us because the documentation or the diagnostics that come out, particularly the graphics that come out, are very helpful in being able to explain to people like the senior management people, if you can have a graph that's keyed into or a series of graphs that are keyed into your analysis that provide kind of a ready-made story to tell to the people that you're doing the analysis for, it's a big help for you. Documentation is important too. Most of us don't like to document, although it is critical. So if there's a means that you can just print or send to a file the particular table that shows the result, that verifies this particular model works on your data, and you put that in your documentation, it's an important consideration for you. Okay. The training issues. Well, this is a big thing. How to begin? Because you're asking people to pick up some fairly complex concepts to do their work. And I think the most effective way is with a training class and then a project tied right to that training class or immediately following the training class, preferably a simple project. Most of the actuarial people I've observed, once they start to see some results, they'll pick up how to use a package fairly rapidly. But you to get them over that initial step where there's a screen looking at them and they're looking back at it and nothing's happening, you have to plan how to make that work for you. Another issue would be, you know, the software is easy to use in relative terms compared to what it was before, but is this modeling tool going to be something that's distributed widely throughout your department? Or is it going to be a specialized skill just with a few people that are routinely used as modelers? The consideration would be just how often will people be using a modeling? Is this going to be something you put into every rate review package so that now, before you've been looking at your territory relativities, just on this one-way basis, do you need to start to model this every time? I don't have answers to those. It's just those questions that come up as you start to think of the implementation. Finally, peer review. This can be a difficult thing because while the packages produce some nice diagnostics, some nice documentation, that the model which I built does have good predictive power. If it's a new thing within your department, you may not have the people on staff to look at the model and agree with you, yes, it does really work. So that you may have to get help from people outside your department. And I'm fortunate in which I can walk down to our research area and ask them to look at it and say, well, did I do the right thing? But if you're a solo practitioner, that's a tough position to be in. And you have to think about what files are the items to include in your files. Last one, when to start the peer review. This is something new to think of because if you get in at the very tail end of the modeling, it can be hard to catch up and understand what all the modeling choices were that were made. So you may, instead of waiting to the end, have to ask to be involved early in the process to understand what the variables are that were created and the different choices that were made in building the data set upon which the analysis is based. Okay, so that concludes my presentation. And now, on to the last thing. Clearly, the real benefit is that you can do better. You can do better today. And when Jeff said, you can look at this in incremental improvements, I'd say that's true. You can start to see improvements today in the modeling assignments that you're taking on in your pricing shop. The costs are that you have to devote time to increase training to staff, and you have to think about how am I going to explain this to my customers. For the most part, they won't like the ANOVA tables, but they'll probably like a graph comparing here's my data, here's my observed observations, and here's my predicted, and the two kind of match up. Your data needs expand a lot. The more you can do, the more you end up being assigned to do, the more data you need to be able to do the work. Okay. And that's it then. On to next one. On to John's presentation. I just press enter, don't I? Okay, and then.
Thank you, Mike. I was really interested to do this session because when I heard the name of it, predictive modeling potentials and pitfalls, I thought, I don't have to prepare anything. I can just stand in front of the room and you'll see a pitfall. But just in case, I did prepare some slides. I want to start today with three objectives, and that is to talk about some basics of rate regulation, and essentially what is the law? And then that will easily glide into the next topic, which is the actual regulatory pitfalls. And then a little discussion of where I think we may be going in the future and what we ought to, and some thoughts for where we'll be going. Now, the laws in Ohio are similar to many states, and so this translates to most states, not all, but this is one of our one of my favorite parts of the law. It's 37 words to say file everything with us. And every insurer shall file with the superintendent of insurance every form of a policy, endorsement, rider, manual of classifications, rules and rates, every rating plan, every modification of any of them which it proposes to use. It's like, wow, it really makes you want to jump up and cheer, doesn't it? So everything has to be filed with us, right? And as you look at that, it sounds like there's no way out. You've got to file everything. Well, there are some things that you do not have to file with us, and we'll get into that a bit. Like the names of your firstborn children, you don't have to be filed with us. Not only do you have to file everything, you've got to support it. And this is another long-winded paragraph. You see that I've shortened it here so it would fit on the slide. But when the superintendent does not have enough sufficient information to determine whether the filing complies with the sections of our code, she may require such insurer to furnish the information upon which it supports such filing. And that does say the word she, in case anybody doubts it. I've been reminded of that back in Ohio. So you've got to file it, you've got to support it. But what are you supporting? Well, you're showing that your rates comply with the three general criteria that we are all familiar with. Some states have the word reasonable thrown in there. Ohio is not reasonable, so we stick with these. And clearly with predictive models, when it comes to rating plans, we're talking about preventing or looking to be sure that a company does not unfairly discriminate. So that's the key issue here that we're looking at. Now, there's one other part of the law that is really will be a transition into the pitfalls, and that is that a filing in Ohio on the day it goes effective will become a public record. And a filing includes all the supporting documentation. The letter from someone on my staff to you saying, please explain how you got this and that. The response back from you, whether it's an email or a letter you send to us. Of course, if you're using SURF, that's another thing. Everything in SURF will be on the public record. Even the letter from me that says it's time to put up or shut up and send us what we're asking for. But everything will be on the public record. And that, of course, leads us into what I think are the pieces that make this a pitfall, make predictive models and regulation of them a pitfall for you. The models are proprietary. Right? That's the first thing, and you all know that. And that means that you've put a lot of time, resources, money into developing a model that helps you to segment your market and to price properly. But the results of the models are incorporated into rating plans. And because of that, they've got the results have to be filed with us. And rating plans are public records. Right. So that is really the heart of this what I would consider a pitfall here, is that you've got to consider what is the regulator going to ask, what does the regulator need? And I think that's one of the purposes for me to be here today, is to help you as you're developing models and developing your methods within your companies to think about, how am I going to file this with the state insurance regulator? What information am I going to use to show that the output of my model, the rating plan I have, really does satisfy the requirements in the law in the state? So here are some questions that we use in Ohio when we look at models. And when we're looking at models, you can also think in terms of credit scoring models, which I think are a subset of the predictive models. And the first thing we look at here is, are any prohibited factors used? So if you filed a model with us, especially your own homegrown model, One of the questions you'll get from us is exactly this. What factors are used in the model? We have to look to be sure that we can say that you're not using some of the obvious prohibited factors, race, creed, color, national origin, but also that you're not using some of the factors that are prohibited by regulations that we have, and that you're using the factors properly. For instance, in Ohio, you may not surcharge for the first not-at-fault accident. Well, that's something we've got to look for. That's in statute. Sometimes statutes are worded so that you may not do something unless you can actuarially support it. Well, the second part of that sentence is not in our code on the not-at-fault accidents. But we're also looking at things like in credit scoring, are you not using medical collection records? That's prohibited by a regulation. And various things of that sort. So we want to verify that the input is appropriate. This next piece is, when you submit a rating plan to us, we have this this quirky desire to want to be able to rate a policy. We think that if you give us the rating plan, we ought to be able to use it. Some companies have some pretty elaborate rating plans, and there's an analyst on my staff who had to pore through a particular company's rating plan that was probably 50 pages long. Of a computer code that was possible to understand, but it was pretty difficult. Nevertheless, we want to be able to rate a policy. And the third is, are the rates that result actuarially sound? And that's really the three things that we're looking at. These questions are really looking at the output of your model. And so when I said earlier on, when I pointed out the first piece of our law that you've got to file everything, you don't have to file the nitty-gritty details of your model, although it would help. That's not absolutely necessary. What we're trying to do is answer these questions. Now, I have an example for you, recent example. I'm not going to give you the name of the company, but this is something that we saw recently. And the company has a model that uses 11 characteristics. Here's the first page of them, and the characteristics have varying levels of categories. So for instance, insurance bureau score or credit score has 12 different levels that they use, and ratio of drivers to vehicles, 3 levels, and so forth. And on down through the 11th one, and each one has a different number of levels, and those are all those combinations of those different characteristics, and the levels of those characteristics are mapped into 43 different tiers. So the question arises, can we rate a policy? Now, I know because I've talked to this company that on about 2, 3, 4 pieces of paper, they could put all the information we need to rate a policy. Convert these categories to numerical values, apply weights to them, sum the results, scale it into the 43 different tiers, and you'd have your answer. However, that piece of information is proprietary. So in its place, we got an exhibit. Right? This is the beginning of the exhibit. I just chopped off the first part of it here. And you'll notice that all the variables are there laid out across the in columns. And you see at the top, this is price point one. So we've got 43 different price points to go through. Right? Now, I know you're all mathematically inclined, so we need a little bit of arithmetic. There are 373,248 different combinations of these levels of characteristics. That's a lot of combinations. At 21 combinations per page, it's 17,774 pages. Right? That's a lot to look at. Now, that many pages is 36 reams of paper, right? Now, if you know, a ream is a stack of paper, it's 500 sheets. 36 of those stand 6 feet tall, right? But I like this measure better, that if we lay them end to end, they'll stretch 16,290 feet, 3 feet, and that is over 3 miles of paper. Right? So this is the problem, I think, that exemplifies a problem that we are having in regulation with predictive models. That company could have easily added a couple more categories, double the number of categories for one of those factors, and increase this to 6 miles of paper. And how are we going to analyze this? Now, fortunately, what that company did send to us was an Adobe file, huge as it is, and it's still possible for us, theoretically possible, to go through that Adobe file and find every combination. So if I wanted to find the combination that is A1, B1, C1 all the way through, I could theoretically search through the Adobe file and find it, right? But that's, we're on the verge now of models with output that is becoming so complex and so large that it's going to cause problems at the regulatory level. Because how do you file that rating manual when it's starting to stretch into miles and miles of paper? Now, if you're looking closely at that exhibit that showed the top of the file that this company sent to us, I looked at it and said, that looks an awful lot like an access report, which tells me that there's one or more access tables behind this, and I think that may be an avenue in the future, that instead of sending us this monstrous Adobe file, that we would be asking a company, send it to us in some sort of table. Send it to us in some sort of format that we can search through, sort these things, and test to see, for instance, if I go from the Insurance Bureau score level A1 to A2, what's the general impact on rates? Well, I'd need to look at all the combinations where there's an A1 and all the combinations where there's an A2. And so you can see the problem of just going through this and verifying that the factors are used properly is becoming a very difficult problem. So the question of rating a policy is one that we're going to have to continue addressing. One other comment, and that is the Department of Insurance in Ohio, this may be true for many of you in your companies and firms, that we're all still working in a paper format. And I think the Adobe file is an example of that. That it still prints out in what looks like 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, but it's a computer file. Perhaps what we've got to do is look beyond the paper approach, that paper format. But that's just options for the future that I think we need to think about. But I want to get on to the next issue, and that is how do we determine whether the actual output is actuarially sound? So I thought I'd give us a little past, present, and future look at this. These are things most of you you should all be pretty familiar with. In the past, we had the loss ratio analysis. When we looked at classification, here are the classification two territories. It's pretty straightforward. One of the advantages of this was that it was easy to explain. To an insurance commissioner, easy to explain to legislators. Remember, the legislators are the ones who wrote that law, that the 37 words that you've got to file everything. So explain to legislators how you rate policies, and of course, explain to consumers. So that was nice and easy. I've used loss ratio analyses to explain to consumers why the rate in their territory is higher than it is in other areas. Of course, as actuaries, we've progressed beyond that. It's probably not appropriate to call this present or recent past, because the minimum bias technique has been with us for some time. But it is a little more modern than, I would call it a more modern approach than the loss ratio relativity analysis. We're addressing the differences in results due to the distribution of class in territory and territory in class. And this type of an approach is also fairly straightforward to explain, although it's not as simple to explain as the loss ratio or our peer premium analysis. But it's not too bad. I will tell you that, a slight story aside, that I had to sit down with our commissioner in Ohio. Her title is the director. I sat down with the director and had to explain medical malpractice company's minimum bias approach. They determine their territory relativities and their class factors using minimum bias. And she wanted me to explain to her how it all fit together. And so we had a couple other people in the room, her communications people and all this. I have to say that when I explained to her that what the technique does is it minimizes the impact of the different distribution of classes of doctors by territory, and does the and vice versa for territory on classes. The director in Ohio, she got it. The other folks were puzzled, but this is something that can be explained. It's complex to explain. You know, usually you face people's eyes glazing over when you get into it, but the folks who are really dedicated can hang in there with you as you explain how minimum bias works. But we're not talking about minimum bias today. We're talking about these creatures. Well, I don't know where the capital M's and such came from, but that's what happens when you convert from one PC to another. This is essentially a fairly basic formula for a linear model. But in any case, how do we explain these kinds of things? In fact, I think if you look on your handout, you'll see how that's supposed to look. But in any case, how do we explain this? How do I explain to a legislator, a commissioner, a consumer, that a formula like this is determining their rates? It's very difficult. And I might say it's actually impossible.